Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching The Future is Female, the show where we find the extraordinary in every woman. Joining me on the show today, I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Angela Bass, who is a director of Amnesty International. She's the first from Malaysia to be appointed to the board. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to, I was reading your background, it's really wonderful to read such, you know, such an extensive CV. You know, the first person from Malaysia to be on the board of Amnesty International. You're also a psychologist, as a trauma specialist, and you are a model. So can you walk me through all these different, very distinctive careers that you've had? I mean, how you went from the catwalk to psychology to human rights?
Well, actually, they're all interrelated. So as a researcher and as an academic, I'm a fan of intersectionality, how our multiple identities affect one another. And I think mental health is a human right. I think climate change is a human right. And I think very often women are pigeonholed into, you're either this or you're that. So you'll see examples of that, you know, you're either a stay-at-home mom or you're a working mom, and you know how it can be pitted against one another. Yeah. So a lot of times it's, oh, you're a model, you must necessarily be stupid. Or if you're a psychologist, you must necessarily be frumpy. And I love shattering stereotypes. Mm. So I love being a psychologist in Jimmy Choo's. It's okay.
Nice, yes. I want to talk to you about the stereotypes, and I think that's interesting. But I do want to get a better understanding of the role of a director of Amnesty International. What does that entail specifically?
So we have, I mean, it's sort of parallel things. We have fiduciary details that we need to be at the vanguard of, but we also help create strategy. Mm. And we're sort of the stewards of the values and mission of Amnesty International, which has about 7 million supporters worldwide.
Sure.
And, it's an amazing organization to be a part of. It's a Nobel Peace Prize winning organization, and we've been calling injustices out since 1961.
And what is the area that's close to your heart? What do you feel most resonates with you?
In all honesty, climate change. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you look at it, it's an umbrella for everything. Because whether we're trying to, for example, abolish the death penalty or work on indigenous land reform or land rights, none of that, even mental health, will matter if we don't have a world, an earth. And at the way we're going with the degree of warmth and the increases, I see a lot of teenagers, 17, 18-year-olds in therapy. And the American Psychological Association actually has a term for it, ecological angst. A lot of these teenagers are like, you know, adjusting for maybe, let's say, normal teenage behavior and hormonal changes. What's the point of studying? Look at right. the world. Like, what are we going to be left with, you know, because people like you and me, we still had led a decade, two or three, of a fairly decent life. Mm. But, you know, activists like Greta Thunberg, right? They're like, what are you doing? Because we will feel the repercussions. So it all ties in, the mental health, the climate. And
I'm so glad you brought up Greta Thunberg, because I wanted to look at that specifically, the Greta Thunberg effect, right?
Yeah.
Whether her activism has changed the way we look at the climate crisis, for better or for worse. I mean, there were a lot of detractors who came out and said, you know, she's 16 years old, what does she know? She oversimplifies solutions. What are your thoughts on the Greta Thunberg effect?
Well, I mean, I think when you try to please everyone, you'll end up pleasing no one. And a lot of times that's a cause for inaction. But at the end of the day, when we look at it from the sort of social media landscape that we're in right now, how is it that we're talking about her in Malaysia? She's a living room household name.
Right, exactly.
So, yes, she's one. And I will tell you, as a woman, it's especially... it's something that especially makes me smile. You know you're getting close when people start getting rattled and they're like, what do you know? It's just age.
Right.
And they start going after her looks. She's a 16-year-old, you know, and she's a disruptor, and it's disrupting the status quo. I mean, Amnesty awarded her our highest award because she was one schoolgirl outside of parliament, and now look, she's catalyzed millions.
Right.
So if that's not the definition of success, I don't know what is. And I also think as adults, we tend to overcomplicate things. children or spiritual can often be sponges. Keep it simple. Mm. It's not too hard. And she's actually walking the talk, whether it's, going by a sailboat and so on and so forth. So I like the fact that she makes adults distinctly uncomfortable.
Do you think, in your line of work, do you think that this, the grassroots movement of the climate crisis conversation that's really changed this year or picked up this year, do you think that's one that is almost segmented to just youth? I wonder whether we're not including decision makers, older people, the other generation as part of this, and whether that's to the detriment of this movement.
So that's a really good question. I'll start with what I said at the World Economic Forum meeting in China. We have now lost the ability to silo solutions to any one particular demographic or civic space or institution. Everybody needs to be behind this, whether you're a teenager, a stay-at-home parent, an industrialist, a government official, because this is everyone's issue. Right. Planet Earth is our home. It's interesting. I think it depends where you are and whom you're speaking to and what social economic status. I know adults in, let's say, Zimbabwe and in other countries in Africa, indigenous tribes that are so in touch with nature that they're having a conversation about climate change, and it looks something like, when I used to put my grandchildren asleep 5 years ago, I only needed to use one blanket. Why do I need to use three?
They're feeling the effects.
Absolutely.
Of that.
Okay. They see it. Like, why is the planting or the harvesting delayed? What is happening? Mm. South Africa is not known for having typhoons, but it had two. Mm. So people are taking notice. But I think sometimes, especially in our eco bubble that is KL, we're like, what problem?
That's right. Has that conversation translated here? How do you deal with that when people here feel like they're insulated from the effects of the climate crisis, which is bizarre to say the least, but because, sometimes the fires in the Amazon forest feel so far away that
until the smog hits us, wait a second, those are my lungs, right? And it's a sad reality that it needs to hit us on such a visceral level for us to say, ooh. Mm. And the thing is, when something happens all the time, and this is sort of almost a trauma principle, it becomes familiar, and when something becomes familiar, it's comfortable, and then therefore it must be okay. Just because the smog hits us like clockwork, or the haze rather, every year, doesn't mean it's okay.
Mm. And we've normalized it almost,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. That's the word. We've normalized it, and it's not been around long enough to see the longitudinal effects of what that means. Mm. Young people are disproportionately like babies, and elderly, right? The asthmatic, bronchital conditions. It's not a good thing when schools across Malaysia are shut.
Yeah, and you can barely see visibility, right?
Yeah.
So, you mentioned that you made that statement about we've lost the ability to operate in silos when it comes to addressing the climate crisis at WEF. How was that accepted? What was the response to that?
They looked at me and they nodded in agreement.
Mm. Do you think that... that
and then I was asked a fun question of as a psychologist, should you call out leaders, if they have a personality disorder? And I don't think it takes creativity to figure out which leader we're talking about, right?
And what was your response?
My response was, so there's a Goldwater rule for psychologists. You can't diagnose someone you haven't seen in therapy. But if someone happens to be the head of state of one of the most powerful nations on earth and are making decisions that literally have knock-on effects, I think you're well in place to break that rule. I think it's the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people. So psychiatrists and psychologists have written an open letter saying that, said head of state most likely has narcissistic personality disorder because, it's just...
How detrimental has, apropos to nothing, how detrimental has the Trump administration been to the fight against the climate crisis, in
very,
your opinion?
Because, as we know, it's like a contagion effect. People take a cue from your sort of nervous system, your leadership style. If you're powerful and you have other factors that make the, countries around you listen, then all eyes are literally on you. Mm. And I mean, even putting climate change in the, you know, the crisis rather, it's not a change, it's a crisis aside, I can't tell you how many people have bullied, committed sexual assault. And I mean, recently there was a case where a woman ran over a Mexican citizen because the president said you could.
Right. It comes from the top, right?
It does. You set the tone at the top. So whether you're a parent, you're setting the tone in your household, you're a president of a company, you're a CEO, of course. Mm. And the thing is, like we were talking about, I don't think it needs to be, you know, one direction. It should be a multi-pronged approach. So grassroots to treetops, and treetops to grassroots and middle out, all of us.
Mm. Is there a country that you're watching and you're thinking, okay, they're aware of the crisis, they know what's happening, and they're trying to, I mean, this is not going to be a silver bullet solution. We're not going to solve this overnight without everyone's help. But is there a country that you're looking to and you think, okay, we should be looking that direction?
And I like what you're saying. And of course, besides silver bullets, every country's cultural context is different. So, you know, that's important too. But yes, I'm a big fan of Costa Rica, and I will be there in 2020. And they are, you know, a country that is not even carbon neutral, but carbon negative. So they don't actually have a military. They took what their military budget would be and put it towards education. And they're a blue zone. So a blue zone is like, you know, a pocket in the Mediterranean, Osaka, where people live over 110 because it's so healthy. So, and this year, you know, with the Young Global Leader program, mm-hmm. the president of Costa Rica is in my cohort, and I'm really looking forward to learning. And then, of course, Scandinavian countries always bear a torch in leading the way with
sure.
these kind of things.
I mean, we kind of expect Scandinavian countries to, you know, lead in this respect, but yeah. Costa Rica is new. I've learned something new. Thank you for that. Yeah. All right, we're going to continue our conversation shortly on The Future's Female. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for staying with us on The Future's Female. I'm Melissa Idris. I'm chatting today to Dr. Angela Bass, a director of Amnesty International. She's the first from Malaysia to be appointed to the board. And we're talking about climate change and human rights. And you made this wonderful connection a little bit earlier, but I'm wondering whether in your line of work you've seen that people make that correlation in their heads immediately, that the climate crisis is in fact a human rights issue.
No, not necessarily. Mm. A lot of times, I mean, I'll get this on my social media, human rights, that's such a Western import.
Really?
What human rights issue? Like, okay.
How do you respond to that?
Well, it depends on the person,
whether
for sure, right?
Whether you want
right?
to respond.
Well, I mean, you know, is it a troll? Is it worth my energy? But generally, if someone genuinely believes that, then I view that as a teachable moment.
Okay.
So in May this year, I was in Greenland. With the World Economic Forum, they chose 20 people to travel to Greenland and study with leading climate scientists. And, you know, in psychology, you understand that you can know something theoretically, you can know something abstractly, but it's experientially, when you experience it, that it changes your life.
Right.
And I remember my colleagues and I were sort of meditating at a fjord. We were looking at an iceberg that's kind of skyscraper size, and so beautiful. And then they returned back to the same the iceberg in the evening, and in front of their eyes it broke in half. It was very real. I cannot tell you how it moved me. It literally changed my life. And the waves that started to rise were like tsunami level, and they started to run. That footage 2 weeks later was used by Vice President Al Gore when he was teaching climate change. And when I came back to Malaysia, people are like, climate change, whatever. But it's about tailoring your message and understanding the cultural context. And at one point, I'm like, it's going to be so hot in a decade, you can't do your annual pilgrimage to Mecca. You can't go. And then all of a sudden, people are like, oh, now this hits home. If you're speaking to, you know, Bangladesh, I don't think they want to be lectured to, in the sense that they're not, I mean, and this is a sad irony. Countries in this part of the world are not even responsible for the majority of carbon emissions.
Sure.
Yet we'll be the first to be hit. Bangladesh will be the first to be submerged.
Right.
You know, so.
Do you see a gendered element or a gendered impact of the climate crisis?
Yes, absolutely. Good question. Again, going back to intersectionality, this the climate change, let's say, you know, cutting down, deforestation, that disproportionately affects indigenous people, a lower middle social economic status.
Right.
And those hardest hit are young people and women. You know, you see that even in disasters and, you know, like man-made or otherwise,
right.
even in war, it's the women that suffer the most. So yes, there is a gender component.
And because of that, is there a way for us to rally the troops, so to speak, you know, to get the messaging out so that women are more, perhaps even in, you know, household decision-making, you know, opportunities to make climate conscious decisions? Is there a way for us to reach out to women?
And I think, I mean, some schools in KL are doing wonderful jobs. They're having, parenting is an equal opportunity thing, hopefully, but still the emotional and cognitive burden of parenting, unfortunately, disproportionately falls on mothers. That's why I'm just addressing reality.
Sure.
They're usually the ones, I see this in my practice all the time, responsible for homework, tutorials, picking up, dropping off.
The emotional work as well, right?
They have three jobs at least, right? So, but schools are doing a wonderful job of incorporating climate science in the curriculum.
Okay.
So I have friends of mine that are mothers that are showing me like recycling projects. Their 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds are doing. It's fantastic.
That's really
and you
good.
Can make it a whole family project. You know, and something, it doesn't, don't need to change the world. Sometimes people are paralyzed with anxiety. Where do I start? I go to a restaurant all the time in Malaysia, and for 6 months I was like, stop with the plastic straws. And after 6 months, no straws. It's good.
That's
so it's
good.
Just
that's,
little
that's,
baby steps, persistence.
You know, you mentioned it, some people are paralyzed with this feeling overwhelmed.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned ecological angst by youth. So as a psychologist, does it feel, when we talk about the climate crisis, it feels like it's insurmountable? How do you deal with that in saying, listen, you know, you're not too small to play a part? Because often we feel, oh, one person cannot possibly make a difference in the climate crisis.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was in Greenland, I made a video, and so many influencers in Malaysia helped share that video and have it viewed. If every single person said, I can't make a difference, that leads to collective apathy. If everybody's like, I can do my bit, imagine if 8 billion people said, I will take a 5-minute shower instead of 10 minutes. Do you know how much water we save? So every single, like, let's say if you're donating, every single coin, every single effort, it doesn't need to necessarily be monetary, makes a difference.
Mm.
If everybody just shut one light off in a room in their house, collectively, it adds up. And we see that. I mean, look at who we vote into power, look who we take off.
Right.
Every vote matters.
Every vote matters. So you are, you know, speaking to private citizens to make a change. You've also engaged at a governmental level, at an international level. What about businesses? Because that's where the bulk of the emissions, the bulk of the behavior that we need to change lies with corporates, with big business. Are you engaging the private sector at all?
Yeah, very much so. So I'm part of an organization called YPO, Young Presidents Organization, and it's very interesting because they did a worldwide survey where, like, their parents were predominantly concerned about success, but this generation is predominantly concerned about significance and sustainability.
Right.
And so there is a real hunger for that.
Mm.
And I would argue that corporates in a lot of places are more powerful than governments.
Mm.
So that's absolutely right, who we need to be having dialogue with, and a win-win, because a lot of times people think, you know, we'll lose out monetarily, but going green and, you know, divesting, for example, from fossil fuels, you can still make a lot of money. They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
For sure. Good. I mean, good sustainable practices can often lead to profitability.
Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, the other stakeholder in this, I'm thinking, is the media, right? The media is responsible.
So important.
Responsible for sustaining that conversation, because one conversation on the climate crisis is not going to be enough. In your observation of the conversations happening on the media, traditional media, what is missing from that conversation?
Well, it's really interesting. I think whether it's feminism or even climate change, a lot of times it's just topical and surface level.
Mm.
Seems popular, seems cool, it's a buzzword, hashtag, But if you delve into it, there's a lack of deeper understanding. So maybe doing thoughtful pieces, experiential, of like what it means to lose land, or actually profiling a child that has legitimate fears for their country to go underwater, and that's why I'm not studying. I don't think I see enough of those kind of stories around. Mm. You know, I just gave a talk recently on exam stress, and a lot of the parents and teachers were looking at me because they had never factored in the idea that kids don't want to do exams, not because they're being lazy. They're like, what's the point? Because right. of what world left? Who cares? Why all this effort? And they're like, oh, like, start having these conversations. And we know, you know, whether we're trying to get over a breakup, a bereavement, there is a place to grieve. You can't shortcut that process. But there's also a place for action, which is extremely liberating.
There's so much psychology involved in the way we live our lives, which then impacts the planet, right? Hmm. Where do you think that... What do you think is required of a real mindset shift? Because I think most people watch a documentary and they, you know,
it's a feel-good moment.
And maybe the behavior changes, very short-term change. How do we create a lasting impact in our behaviors, in our mindset?
Well, here's the good news: you only need 10% of a said population, a given population, to reach a tipping point. So if 10% of people get behind
only
something.
Only 10%?
Yeah, only 10%.
Oh, wow.
And then everyone's like, oh, and that actually catches on. And, you know, in modern parlance, it kind of goes viral. Aristotle once, I'm paraphrasing, said, you know, greatness is built on daily habits. And I think it's redefining what's cool. So when people give me presents, I mean, I try to be gracious, but everybody knows, like, you know, in a couple of days, it's Christmas. Everyone knows by now, do not give Anjula a present. Why? Capitalist consumerism?
Right.
No. You know, go on Kiva, donate, like microfinancing, loans to somebody. I don't want to unwrap, I mean, I appreciate the thought, but I don't want to unwrap paper. I don't want to do all this.
Right.
So wasteful. Do a conference call. Why travel? Utilize technology. And it's just about what is cool and what is not. And we've seen in history, things across the world that were just normal are now looked at as barbaric. What were you thinking?
Right.
So it's high time we turn these things into not cool. So not cool.
Well, this comes
plastic,
back.
Plastic, not cool.
I mean, we've come full circle to what you started in the beginning about breaking stereotypes. And this is, again, breaking the stereotype of what is expected behavior for, you know, Christmas, what is expected behavior for showing someone you care through consumerism. Mm. We have to break that stereotype and say, well, you know, I love you and I want you to have a planet. You know,
correct.
I want that to be the legacy, and perhaps we can create a conversation about that. In the last couple of minutes we have left, I actually really want to come back and touch on some of your other advocacy work. What are some of the issues that you feel really close to your heart when it comes to creating a more more gender equality?
Well, you hit the gender. It's a brilliant time to be a woman in this universe and on this earth. But I hope for our daughters and the next generation, it's not as tedious. I mean, every single day, what I have to hear on social media or what I see, it's we are far from equality. And at any given point, I mean, I remember sitting on a board and following up on a piece of work, and the guy's like, are you crazy? And, you know, traditionally, women have been called crazy, hormonal, all kinds of things.
Sure. Like my emotional.
Absolutely. Mm. My husband and I just laugh. Like when he's assertive and knows what he wants, I'm aggressive, right? And
or bossy.
Absolutely. Mm. And at every moment, you know, you have an opportunity to change the dialogue. We're always getting people to think, and that's the least that we can do. We can't change people if they're not willing to change at that moment, but get them to think, start a conversation. Because a lot of times you'll hear, whether it's at a dinner party or even with family, well, that's just the way it's always been.
It doesn't have to be.
Not at all. I mean, my parents were recently visiting, and I think it's that old school mindset of, I want my child to be secure and I want to bequeath you this and that. And I just kind of looked at my mom, and she just had this moment. She it was at Batu Caves, maybe the gods were smiling at us. I'm just like, why would I need that? I am comfortable no amount, it doesn't matter how much wealth I accumulate, I don't need a bigger flat. take that property, go put it in a climate initiative action. And she's just looking at me. She's like, oh. And we have to rewrite what that means.
That's right. So we have to kind of rewire some of the old thinking.
Totally.
Right? Change the conversation. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the show. I'm Melissa Idris, and that's all the time we have for this episode of The Futures Female. I will be back with you same time next week. Thank you for watching, and good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.